from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum in our next hour, neuroscientist Daniel Levitin gives practical advice to those of us drowning in email, constantly misplacing our belongings, and struggling to multitask. His new book is called The Organized Mind, and we'll talk with him about staying focused and productive in the face of information onslaughts. Daniel Levitin is also the author of The World in Six Songs and This Is Your Brain on Music. He joins us in studio next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. Managing information flow in the information age as we become increasingly inundated becomes an ever-escalating and often more and more formidable challenge. Now, Daniel Levitin, cognitive scientist and McGill professor of psychology and neuroscience, provides a neuroscience and self-help roadmap to better processing and structuring of our experiences and all the onslaughts of information that compel us to do what is too often called multitasking. The author of This Is Your Brain on Music and The World in Six Songs, Daniel Levitin's most recent book, which just made number two on the New York Times bestseller list, is titled The Organized Mind, and he joins us for this morning's second Forum Hour. Good to have you back here with us. Welcome.
Oh, it's great to be back, Michael.
Well, you know, it's funny. As I was reading your book, I just came across something in the Harper's Index. This is just one of the things that I wanted to throw out for people to think about, really to sort of muse about. The brain storage capacity actually is the equivalent of 1 million gigabytes of hard drive space, just so you know what kind of space you have in there that you're capable of. But I started thinking about, I almost found myself compelled to think about, as a result of your book, what happens just when you lose your keys? You know, we used to think psychopathology of everyday life. I lost my keys because there must be a secret meaning to it. A lot of times just you're too distracted. You got too many things on your mind.
I think that's it. I think it's information overload is causing us to think we're experiencing cognitive decline, but we're not. Too many things to keep track of.
Well, there's all this wonderful neoplasticity of the brain. You know, you can shift. I talk about all these gigabytes and all these different modes that you write about. And so multitasking seems like an easy and an appropriate thing to do. But you talk about the waste of oxygenated glucose, and it's best to take things one step at a time or one thing at a time, yeah?
We now know this from two different avenues of research. There's research on productivity, which shows that people who multitask actually get less done than people who don't. They just think they're getting a lot done, and their work is less creative. And then on the neuroscience side, we know now from the work of Earl Miller at MIT and many others, the brain doesn't multitask. It engages in sequential tasking or unitasking, where we're shifting rapidly from one thing to another without realizing it. Now you say, but I know that I'm multitasking. I'm driving and I'm texting and I'm emailing and I'm surfing the web all at once. But you're not. Your brain's doing one thing at a time, fractionating your attention into little bits. And what this does is it, for one thing, causes you to burn up this oxygenated glucose at a much more rapid rate. It releases the stress hormone cortisol. And in the end, you know, I think the reason we think we're so good at it is because it feels good. But I can tell you as a neuroscientist, the brain is very good at self-delusion.
Well, you're deluded into thinking you're accomplishing more when indeed you may be obviously accomplishing less. But there's also the real injunction in this and the real necessity to be attentive, to concentrate, to focus. I mean, that's what really comes through in this. And you talk about the scientific. There's also, well, you think about mindfulness in the Buddhist religion and all the study that work that Dan Goleman and people like that have done. Keeps telling us the same thing, focus, focus, focus. You
know? Focus, but it's not the same as if you're focusing on five things when you're focusing on one.
And no, I mean when I say focus, exactly. be focused on one thing as opposed to, or don't stratify or fractionalize your focusing. This is also a whole question of sensory overload. You know, I mean, there's a real danger of that, isn't there?
There is. And there's a reset button, it turns out, that we evolved in a different attentional mode called the daydreaming mode. Neuroscientists also call it the task negative network. Daydreaming mode's a little more poetic, perhaps. And we've all experienced this mode, and it is the reset button. It allows you to basically refresh and release those neural circuits that get all bound up when you're focused. So you want to focus, of course, on one thing, mindfulness, Zen-like attention, undistracted, but not for too long. You need to give your brain a break. And the daydreaming mode, you've probably experienced it. Michael, have you ever been reading a book and you found your eyes got ahead of your brain?
It happens all the time.
Your eyes were following the words, and then you realize, I don't know what I've been reading. I got to go back. That's the daydreaming mode, hijacking your attention, giving your brain a break, allowing thoughts to connect to one another that aren't normally connected, a loosely organized set of ideas that one follows the other in a kind of sometimes nonsensical or nonlinear way. That's the refresh, the reset button.
Talking with Daniel Levitin, his new book is The Organized Mind, and evolution didn't really design us for this, all this information age digital stuff, did it?
Well, this goes back to an idea I first heard about from Robert Sapolsky, the great biologist at Stanford.
He's one of our local people here, yeah.
And he talks about the idea of evolutionary lag. When environmental conditions change, the genome will eventually respond. The question is, how long is eventually? And in many cases, it's thousands or tens of thousands of years. So we can be said to have brains that were optimized for life the way it was 5, 10,000 years ago, not the way it was. And think about life 10,000 years ago. You probably knew 100 people, and you might encounter 200 or 300 in your entire life. And the information that you knew, pretty much everybody in your tribe or family knew. I mean, what there was to be known, everybody shared in. Now we walk down downtown San Francisco, you could run into 1,000 people in an hour and a half. And the amount of information coming at us, it's 5 times more today than what we were taking in 1986. It's the equivalent of each of us reading 174 newspapers every day, cover to cover.
No, you can't adapt to that.
I mean, you
can't. It's simply impossible. Plus, as you point out in your book, there's so much trivial and mundane information that's coming into us as opposed to more significant or more important. And to sort all that through, to organize it, to be better informed, but also to be better informed in terms of what you really need to focus on. I keep using that word.
In a Zen-like mindful way.
Let's hope so, yeah. But, I mean, this becomes part of the whole challenge of how to organize your brain, really, doesn't it?
Right. So, one of the things I did that was really fun in writing the book is that I spent time with a lot of highly successful people and tried to figure out what their strategy.
You even call them HSPs, right?
Right.
I never saw that before. What their strategies for organization are, yeah. Tell us about that. I mean, you actually got an opportunity to interview people like Bloomberg and Sting and our own local figure, George Shultz, but also bring in other famous people that can tell us something about. I mean, a lot of people think if you organize your brain too much, you're going to be, especially all these people who have personal assistants to help them organize, you know, you're going to get away from your creativity or lose your innovative powers. But boy, you call our attention to people like John Lennon and Michael Jackson. They were almost super anal organizers, you know?
Yeah, they were. And so I think when I'm talking about being organized, I want to be clear, I'm not talking about a world where all of us are Mr. Spock and we're just, you know, automatons. I think the idea is that if you become more efficient at home and at work, more efficient in time management, it allows for greater spontaneity and creativity in the day, every day. You can spend more time doing the things you like, spend more time with loved ones. That's what the ultimate goal is, I think.
There is a notion, though, that you are, by thinking freely, by letting your brain just roam, opening yourself up for more innovative or creative possibilities. I think that's been pretty much measured, hasn't it?
Yeah, and that works. So I think so many of us feel that if we stop work for even 5 or 10 minutes, we're going to fall inextricably behind. But the research shows that that's not true. People who take breaks, regular breaks, and naps even, end up being more productive and more creative in their work. You need to give your brain time to consolidate all of the information that's come in, to toss it and turn it.
sort of like, you know, what judges do in a courtroom after they take in all the information after days or weeks of trial. They'll often say, I'm going to take that under advisement for a couple of days. You know, I'll render my decision in 2 days. They're tossing and turning it over. And I think we need to make more time for reflective, careful, creative thought. When I think about the big problems that face the world, poverty, the uneven distribution of wealth, aggression across national boundaries, within national boundaries now, I think if we could have figured out how to solve these problems in a kind of normal linear way, they'd already be solved. These are going to require somebody thinking outside of the box, thinking creatively, trying to connect ideas that hadn't been connected together before. And I think
and a more organized brain enables that more, or is
it does
simply connected to that to a greater degree?
Right.
Well, we're also, I mean, you give some pretty practical advice here. The sort of thing like take breaks. You know, using examples of air traffic controllers or simultaneous translators. Obviously, they need breaks. You also say leave your work at work, which is very hard for some of us. I mean, I have so much information to absorb. It's just the nature of the work that I do that I'm at it all the time. You know, there's sometimes almost no time for breaks and what we need in terms of downtime. But my brain is not as organized as a result. It's kind of a mishmash, probably.
Well, there are some jobs that require constant attention. Broadcast journalist is a print journalist. A news journalist is certainly one of those jobs where to do your job effectively, you can't disengage for too long. But you can take little breaks, 5-minute breaks here and there during the day and in the evening. The idea about leaving work at work, the observation from spending time with some of these highly successful people, what struck me about them was how present they are. We were talking about mindfulness. That when they're doing something, they're really doing it.
They're in the moment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so they get more done because their brain isn't half somewhere else. I think so many of us, when we're at work, we're thinking about home and our loved ones. And when we're at home, we're thinking about all those things at work we didn't do. And as a consequence, you end up not really being in either place.
Well, there's so many distractions. I mean, the Kinsey Institute talked about how often both genders, but particularly men, are thinking about sex, especially at a certain age demographic. You know, I mean, they're just all the distractions that one can constantly be privy to and
yeah.
pray to. You know,
yeah.
And so that requires sometimes concentrating on the importance of concentrating, almost, doesn't it?
Yeah. So one of the things I talk about in the book is the advice of the efficiency guru David Allen. Which is externalize, get it out of your head. So he recommends something that I've started doing that I love now called the mind-clearing exercise. At least once a day, I sit down with a stack of index cards or a pad of paper, and I write everything that's in my head that's distracting me. Don't forget to go to the cleaners. Don't forget to read this article. You owe so-and-so an email. Remember to call so-and-so. I get it all out of my head, and yeah, my brain at this point knows that I've written it down, so it stops nagging me. Hmm. The problem, Michael, is that
does it have to be index cards? I do that sort of thing in a date book, for example.
Doesn't have to be index cards.
You're big on index cards.
A lot of people I spoke to like the index cards because you can if you put one idea per card, you can resort them easily if your priorities change. But yeah, notebook, journal, it doesn't really matter. Whiteboard, it doesn't matter.
But it's somehow the cognitive act of getting it out of your head almost. It's almost cathartic in a way. Huh?
Very important because, you know, 30 years ago, we thought that the conscious brain could hold on to about 10 or 12 chunks of information. We now know that that's not true at all. You can really juggle about 4 things at once. And what you usually want those 4 things to be are the things that are right in front of you that you're immersed in, not nagging voices about things that are disconnected in time and place from where you are.
You give us a lot of solid advice, but what about the fact that even the most computer savvy people are often, well, again, heir to so many distractions? And not only distractions, but reliable information and totally inaccurate information, worthless information, especially young people are just exposed to this constantly. And so how to organize a brain in a way to sort through what is useful, what is accurate, what is really relevant, and what is totally worthless?
What a great question. So this is one of the main things that I'm trying to do at the Minerva Schools at KGI, where I'm Dean of Arts and Humanities here in San Francisco, to teach information literacy to undergraduates. And in fact, I think the primary mission of educators going all the way down to grammar school has to change, and it has to change right away. For hundreds of years, the purpose of education was to fill people full of facts and formulas. And in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, and Avogadro's number, and the sun is 93 million miles away, and it takes 8 minutes for light to get here. All these little facts that we used to memorize, which you can now get in half a second on your phone. What we have to start teaching children, I think, from the age of 8 or so, is how to tell the difference between information and misinformation, to understand that there are facts as well as pseudo-facts, that there are hierarchies of evidence. And this is what our first-year curriculum at Minerva is about for undergraduates. And I'll give you an example.
You're both at Minerva and McGill now?
Yeah.
Talk about multitasking. Huh?
I'll give you an example of information literacy in the modern age. Suppose you're interested in finding out about a new medication. Maybe it's been prescribed for you or a family member. You want to get some information. So you put it into Google, and you go to the first hit that comes up. Now, the question that any 8-year-old should know how to ask is, whose website is this? Is it operated by the company that makes the drug? Is it operated by a competing manufacturer? And can you imagine what biases might enter into the information they care to share? Or maybe it's a shill organization called, I don't know, AmericansForBetterHealthcare.com, and it sounds completely neutral, but it's actually functioning as a shill for some partisan view. Understand that if you go to a site that ends in .gov, like CDC.gov or NIH.gov, you might get more neutral information.
These are good things to tell young people, good things for adults to keep in mind, too. Is there an innate ability, though, when it comes to organized mind? You know, you do see all these famous people, rock stars and actors and everything, with personal managers and people who kind of tell them, you know, you're supposed to email this person or you're supposed to go to the dentist today or whatever. Help them just keep their days organized, hour to hour, minute to minute. Some people seem to be fabulously organized, almost by disposition, as if it's somehow in their DNA. And some people, myself to some extent, you know, can be, you're looking at another of the almost archetypical absent-minded professors, but, you know, are not necessarily as organized as we'd like to be, let's put it that way, or simply disorganized.
Well, I have two ways to come at this. One is there is some of us are overtly organized, like filers, and then some are only implicitly organized, like pilers. In other words, some people file everything away in a drawer and keep it hidden. Amos Tversky, my former teacher at Stanford, was like that. Desk was preternaturally clean and very intimidating. Other people are pilers. They just make these piles, these sort of, you know, geological time bound piles of things, and this is from last year and this is from 5 years ago, but they know where everything is. It looks disorganized, but it's not. But you're absolutely right. There are genetic components to this. There are alleles that we now believe influence whether you become super organized or not. It's a biological substrate for a personality predisposition. It doesn't mean that you are, it's not deterministic, but if you've got the gene, you're more likely to be conscientious and organized and stick to things and reliable and all these things that cluster together.
But like so many other things, you can enhance whatever your ability or lack of ability, whatever you start out with.
Right. Now, you mentioned people who have personal assistants, and of course, the wealthy often have people that function to organize their lives for them. And part of the purpose in writing the book was to learn what these assistants do so that we could all borrow those techniques in our daily lives, those of us who don't have the assistants.
So what did you learn from people like George Shultz or Sting or Bloomberg, who have certainly the resources to have personal assistants and do?
Well, as we were talking about before, they're totally in the moment. The reason they are is that they have people helping them to prioritize things so that at any given moment in the day, they know that what they're doing is exactly what they should be doing at that moment.
So all of us can learn from that. If you wake up in the morning and you make a list of things and you prioritize them, so that really the more important things you do first, the less important things you save for later, then and you block it off in your calendar and you say, okay, well, for an hour, I'm going to work on the Penske report. And I'm not going to do anything else. I'm not going to check email or answer the phone. This is my Penske time. You don't have to worry that you should be doing something else. You don't have to be distracted because you've managed that in terms of your calendar. Sting actually has 4 hours in his calendar every day for a combination of yoga and creative time. Practicing, but just, you know, open time to do whatever he wants.
He and Trudy spent a lot of time, you know, doing sort of sensual things and everything. They've been very public about that. I mean, more time than most people allocate, especially when they've been married as long as those two have. We're talking to Daniel Levitin, author of The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. He's also the author of The World in Six Songs and This Is Your Brain on Music. And we're talking about, you know, how to get your mind more organized and ways. There's a lot of practical tips here in terms of organizing your home life, your social life, just your time in general. And talk about the virtue of junk drawers. I mean, I was reminded in reading about this. Paul Auster once said that the difference between writing a memoir and writing a novel is when you're writing a memoir, it's like taking a junk drawer and reorganizing it and just putting everything in different places and all these memories you're hit with from stuff you've kind of stored in there. But with respect to, say, writing a novel, you know, it's an altered state of consciousness maybe. But there is an advantage to having, to putting stuff away, isn't there, just to getting it out of sight, out of mind even?
There is. So I think of, you know, when I talk about organizing, I think that the miscellaneous file and the junk drawer represent a great achievement of cognitive economy. Because if you think, you know, when do you put something in the junk drawer? You have something in your hand and you think, and you know, there's probably a perfect place in your home for this thing if you think about it long enough and hard enough. But it's not worth spending more time on the decision than it's worth. You throw it in the junk drawer, you move on with your life. You know it's there. A good example of this is a lot of people, I don't know about you, but I've got like nails and screws and bolts and miscellaneous things. Now, if I were somebody that was working every weekend, 16 hours a week on home, you know, repair and restoration projects, and I really needed to have a precise number 8 bolt with the coarse threads, it's 1.5 inches long, or, you know, whatever it was, I would probably set up a system like they have at the hardware store with little drawers and everything labeled. But I do it so infrequently, I can just have all the nails and screws in a box, a miscellaneous box. And then when I actually need one, I spend the time looking for it rather than, you know, all this time sorting it. The junk drawer is kind of like that.
Well, let me open the phone lines. Those of you listening, how do you organize your day and what kind of clues do you take and what kinds of things do you do that can help you? And, of course, questions about the whole neuroscience of the organized mind and how to get a more organized mind. Daniel Levitin, author of The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. And what about multitasking? We mentioned naps, too. Remember, some of you, we did a whole program on sleep last week and talked about the importance of naps and concentrating. How to better concentrate, how to better organize. I'm sure you have questions. Join us. Our toll-free number is available right now. It's 866-733-6786. That's toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the organized mind or the disorganized mind and how to get it more organized with neuroscientist and author Daniel Levitin, who is here with us in studio, the subtitle, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. And we do welcome your involvement in this program. You are invited, in fact, to join us either toll-free, 866-733-6786, or by email, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. And you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum, or go to Facebook. I want to mention all these things because it's all these social networks, of course, that people can get caught up in now with diversion from attention and the sort of distractions that we're talking about here. And I want to go to calls and emails here. And talk about George Shultz for a moment, though, because you did get an opportunity to interview him. And, you know, he's, like I say, certainly a well-beloved and classical figure here. Classical almost is the correct word nowadays. He's a nonagenarian. He's passed. I think was I at his 90th birthday party or his 80th? I can't remember. See, I'm trying to organize my mind and figure. I think it was his 80th. But what'd you learn from George Shultz?
He's a great intellect. I met him first in 1985 when I was working for Edmund Wattis Littlefield as his personal assistant, as Ed's personal assistant. Ed had been on the boards of General Electric and Chrysler and Del Monte Foods and Wells Fargo Bank and
Bechtel too, probably. Yeah,
yep, and George had been.
George is with Bechtel for
president
years.
President of Bechtel. What I learned
George was also, Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary of State, Secretary of Labor. I mean, he held at least three cabinet positions that I know of, maybe four.
I believe it was four. I don't remember.
Memory doesn't always serve us, does it?
Does. Great intellect, Shultz. And one of the things I learned from him was it's important to know what question to ask to move a decision forward. So a lot of us have these things that we need to decide on, and they kick around on our to-do lists, and we don't get any action on them. And what I learned from Shultz is you have to know what question to ask that will move the decision forward and make it something actionable. So maybe you're trying to decide whether you should keep repairing your old car or get another one, a replacement, new or used. And it's been bothering you, and your car broke down yet again. Why is it you haven't made the decision? Well, it's not well defined. Shultz would say you have to turn these into actionable decisions, like maybe have a conversation with my mechanic. What does he think it's going to cost me to keep this on the road? Find out about new cars and how much they cost to operate. We'll, you know, work through some calculations with somebody about the expenses. Maybe I need to talk to my partner. Those are actionable things. Talk to your mechanic, talk to your partner, work through some numbers. Something amorphous like, do I need a new car or not? Not so actionable, and so it tends not to get done.
So the logic of this is not only asking the right questions, but asking questions that are tied to action.
Right. You know, a former guest on your program, Dan Dennett, the philosopher, when he goes to parties, people say, what do you do for a living? And he says, I'm a philosopher. And they say, what does that mean? And he says, well, I ask questions. They say, that sounds like a puny way to make a living.
Well, that's what I do as a broadcast journalist, too, half the time.
You know which questions to ask. That's the important thing. Which questions move the conversation or the decision forward?
Well, we've got lots of questions and comments for you, but before we go to them, important question to ask. I was kidding about memory before, but how significant and how important is memory in terms of keeping us well organized or keeping us well focused or attentive?
Well, memory is crucial, of course, but I think the key here is to externalize memory whenever you can. And we human beings figured out a phenomenal way to do that about 5,000 years ago when we discovered writing. Write it down. You don't need to remember all these things. They just distract you from, you know, they're in competition with your neurons. For the things you're actually trying to do, as opposed to things you're trying to remember that aren't relevant right this minute.
How many neurons are dying right now in my head, do you think, or yours? New ones are being born, of course, but as we get older, more die, right?
Yeah, I don't know those numbers.
They're significant, aren't they?
Yeah, they are. But the thing is, as we get older, although we lose some processing speed because of white matter atrophy, white matter is the part of the brain that communicates between neurons. Gray matter is the actual
gray matter is where your intelligence is, yeah.
Well, I would argue that the white matter is
as much
an underappreciated part of intelligence because that's the making of connections.
Agreed.
So we make up for the loss of processing speed with wisdom and acquired knowledge, so I think it evens out.
What a nice sanguine view of things. Let me go to our calls. Chris, you're first up here. Good morning. Welcome.
Hey, good morning. Thank you. I wanted to call in regards to this concept of the ideal calendar. I run a financial planning business, so I have a lot of different facets of my business that I have to stay on top of. And one of the key things is there's also tasks that are crucially important, but maybe not the things that I want to do the most, like pick up the phone to call a new prospective client. And so one of the techniques we learned in our business was this ideal calendar where we actually block in phoning times and block in our meeting slots so that I don't have to make decisions point to point on where I'm going to put those things into my day. It's already pre-programmed each week, and I just fill in the slots as I go through my week. So I thought that was just a comment on kind of one of the what you said earlier, Daniel.
Great advice, and fully supported by the research. So if you've got things that you really don't want to do, and you could do them any time, if you just sort of are left to your own devices, you're not going to do them at any time. You won't do them at all. But if you block an hour to do them, and you do them boom, boom, back to back. You know, I talked to a film producer who unfortunately passed away before the book came out, Jake Eberts. He had produced River Runs Through It and Gandhi and Driving Miss Daisy, 60 films in all. And he had this dictum, which was to take the most unpleasant thing you have to do in the day and do it first. He called it eat the frog. Once you get it out of the way, the rest of the day you feel light and free.
Let me thank the caller. Actually, apropos of that advice, here's a tweet from a listener named Jeffrey who says, Charles Emerson Winchester III of MASH was right. Quote, I do one thing at a time. I do it very well. And then I move on to the next.
Beautiful.
And we'll move on to the next call. And it's Sarah joining us. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. My question is, how does gender play a role in this? I'm often told, you know, men and women specifically have seven-year-old twins, a girl boy. And when I see them playing, I notice that their ways of organizing the toys or organizing their play pattern is very different. And I'm wondering, is that a gender thing maybe, or a personality thing, or how does that kind of play, how is that involved in the organization of the in the brain, or maybe both, I don't know.
Sarah, thank you. It's a wonderful example of the interaction between genes and the environment. Male and female are not dichotomous variables. They're two ends of a continuum, and we fall along the continuum in different places, all of us, between male and female. And it's true, males are more likely, for biological and cultural reasons, to want to systematize things, line things up, categorize, make taxonomies. Women are, you know, girls are more likely to, in their play, be organizing the social aspects of things and relationships between things. And that can be, either one can be taught to look at the world in the other way. And I think, in fact, it's a good idea to teach both genders, both kinds of thinking.
You wonder, though, how much endocrines and hormones affect the brain and neuroscience, because obviously they do.
Great point. So testosterone is actually associated with an increased attention to this kind of organizational detail. Of course, women have testosterone, too, and so do men. And progesterone is more associated with a focus on social matters and interactions.
Listener named Anita writes, what does your guest say about all the crazy homework that kids get? My 10-year-old has 2-plus hours per day after being in school for 6 hours. I believe it's overkill and it doesn't let kids relax.
I think it depends on what the homework is and whether the homework is actually goal-directed and meeting important educational criteria.
I think she's just saying it's too much and it's stressful.
Yeah, I don't have an opinion on how many hours a school child should be working, but I do agree. Children shouldn't be overly scheduled. They should have blocks of time to promote spontaneity and creativity.
Listener looking for some practical advice from you, how to distract myself from social media like Facebook and Twitter and Reddit, any tips?
Well, what I've found the experts do is they partition their day. So other than somebody like Michael, who has to be active along with your producers and your whole team in the other room there, have to be on social networking all the time, what the rest of us can do is limit your Facebook and your Twitter and your Vine and your Instagram and your Tumblr and your Pinterest and all the others to blocks of time. The amount of time is up to you, but you know, half an hour in the morning, a half an hour in the evening. Don't have them on all the time because they're distracting. You have to enforce some kind of break from them.
I think you're right to use the word enforce here. I mean, a lot of people will say, well, I'm just going to go to it at a particular time or only for a half hour, but then they get involved in it much longer than they thought.
It sets up a dopamine addiction loop.
Exactly.
It's just like the addiction we see in cocaine addicts. Every time you click on an email or read a new tweet or see that somebody else put a thumbs up on your Facebook page, it causes a little shot of dopamine. And remember those rats in the experiment in the 1950s, given an opportunity to get a dopamine shot by pressing a bar, they did that to the exclusion of everything else. They died of hunger and thirst. They just wanted the dopamine.
Here's Nick who writes, personally, I need about 2 hours in the morning to wake up before I'll even consider talking to anyone, and these widely favored 15-minute naps put me in the same state. I don't feel any sort of reset, just lethargy. Advice, and thank you both. Thanks, Nick.
There are individual differences in alertness throughout the day and whether naps are effective. Some people benefit from naps and some don't. Learning what your style is and how your brain and body work is very important. That 2 hours in the morning where you don't feel like being social, that's a great time to get some work done. If your work is the type that allows you to work in a solitary way, or to exercise.
I was just going to say, or do exercise, yeah. Things like that. Yeah. Yeah. Felicity writes, I receive hundreds of emails a day, sometimes as many as 1,000 at work, and always fall behind on filing and deleting. I'm too busy to file and organize as they come in, and rarely find time to go back and organize later. Any tips on staying on top of this?
Yeah, I have the same problem, Felicity, and what I've done.
So do I.
What I've done is followed the advice, again, of the experts who I spoke with for the book. Set up a separate email account. With another address, and just give that email account to the people that you really need to be in touch with on a regular basis, your loved ones, your coworkers, and that's the one that you leave on all the time. And then for the other one, you can just condition your correspondence to understand that you're not always going to get back to them. Most email programs allow you to set up an automatic return a message that'll say something like, I'm sorry, I'm overwhelmed by email. I'll get to yours when I can. If this is urgent, send it again. I might have lost track. And then Lawrence Lessig, formerly of Stanford, law professor, he declares email bankruptcy every once in a while, sends an email to everybody and says, sorry, I can't keep up. If whatever you wrote to me about however many days or months ago is still urgent, send it again.
You're starting to get the Canadian accent a little. You said about.
Oh, did I?
I think I heard it. Yeah.
Unconscious.
Daniel Levitin, he's professor at McGill and also here in San Francisco, works with the Minerva Project and is author of The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. And we'll go to more of your calls. Ian, you're on. Good morning.
Yes, hi. It's a great discussion. I have a kind of a naive observation. I don't know if much has been written about this, but and it seems offbeat, but you know, there's been this striking increase in the prevalence of autism spectrum disorders in the last few years, and there's been kind of a parallel rise in the diagnosis of ADHD spectrum disorders. And to me, what they have in common is some difficulty in managing or incorporating sensory input. And I just wonder if you had any thoughts about whether the current environment of sensory overload and information overload is driving basically kind of unmasking personality traits that have been prevalent at some fixed rate forever.
Well, there's a local angle here. I grew up in San Francisco Bay Area, and what's happened here in the last 15 to 30 years, of course, is that we've gotten more high-tech workers, more engineers into the Bay Area, and they're more likely to show these the ASD part, not the ADHD part, the autism part. And so we're noticing a little more in the Bay Area than and in some urban centers than in other parts of the country. The big question, I think, for epidemiologists and neuroscientists is, are there actually more cases of these two, or is it just that we're becoming better at detecting and recognizing them? And we don't have an answer on that. I suspect it's a little of both, mostly better detection. And you're right, there are disorders of coordinating sensory input. On the other hand, people with ADHD can be much more creative. The trick there is to try to harness their creativity and get them to finish projects. And what we see here in Silicon Valley is a lot of people who are distractible get teamed up with people who are not in the workplace. And then the two of them together can get great things done.
Well, it's interesting that autism comes up because I'm looking at a couple of emails, interestingly enough, that are on that topic. Beth writes, I'm interested in Dr. Levitin's views on those who have Asperger's and dislike noise or distractive environments. Once I got rid of the TV and embraced a more minimalist lifestyle, life became more organized overall. And then you have another question from a listener named Aaron who says, has anyone ever done any research into people with autism and dreaming? In other words, do people with autism dream? And if not, perhaps that might be the reason why they withdraw from external stimuli, because they aren't able to purge the unnecessary details from their mind at the end of each day.
I don't know of any work on, Aaron, on people with autism and their dreams. I'm certain that they dream. We're now beginning to understand that they've got a different neural wiring, and that they've got in some parts of the brain too many connections and in some parts not enough. And as a field, we're in the process of mapping that and sorting it out. There may be some interventions that we can do, either pharmaceutical or training interventions early on.
There's an immense amount, though, that we still just don't know.
Right. That's absolutely
pretty
right.
Pretty mysterious. Brandon in Berkeley writes, great quote I wanted to share, not sure who to attribute it to. Quote, an email box is a great repository for other people's priorities, end of quote. Has the guest tried using a computer program instead of index cards?
Well, I like the index cards because they're always with me and I can resort them. I have tried computer programs. A lot of people are still using paper, as you probably read in Sheryl Sandberg's book.
Didn't read it.
Chief Operating Officer of Facebook, and she carries around paper and a notebook. She says she feels like she's carrying around a chisel and a stone tablet in Silicon Valley. But what was the first part of Brandon's question?
We want to know if it was a quote. Email inbox is a great repository for other people's priorities.
I think, you know, the problem with email is that, and getting back to this earlier discussion of leaving your email program on or turning it off so that you can have some breaks from it, the problem with email that we haven't had before is that when an email comes in, you don't know whether it's something that you need to deal with right now, something important, or something that, you know, is a Nigerian prince offering you untold millions of dollars, or another video of a cat playing the piano. You just don't know from that sound of the ping. There are programs that allow you to make different noises for different correspondents, but most people don't take the trouble to set them up. So the problem is you hear that ping and you feel compelled to go check and see what it is. It was a relatively new...
It's almost Pavlovian, isn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, the problem is that as each email comes in, there's nothing to distinguish it from the others. We didn't have this problem with snail mail.
You're right.
I mean, you could tell by looking at snail mail, whether it was personal or business, by the envelope and the stamp and all these other cues that we lack now. So I think, again, we have to enforce time away from email. And if you really do need to be in touch with people, set up a separate email account and give it just to them.
Again, our guest, Daniel Levitin, author of The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. And I'm going to be a good citizen here and say that if you want all the proof you might need in terms of multitasking, we know now, because of research that's come up on this program, that there is as much danger in texting when you drive as there is in drinking when you drive. But I've got a caller here who's a juggler who wants to tell us about multitasking from his point of view. James, you're on. Hi. James, are you there? Well, anyway, James wanted to tell us he's a juggler and he can multitask very easily because of his juggling background. But he somehow didn't go on to tell us that. So we'll go to another caller. Gary, you're on. Hi.
Yeah, good morning. At the start of any given day, my mental to-do list for the day may have several tasks that of my own that I want to do and one or two that my partner wants me to take care of. And at the end of the day, if I have forgotten one of the ones that she has me to put on my mental to-do list, then her theory is I forgot to do it because it wasn't important. My theory is I just forgot to do it because I just had so many things going that day that it wasn't because her idea wasn't important to me. Which of us is right?
But yeah. You're going to address this to a lot of people in partnerships or marital situations who have that as a sore thumb. Daniel Levitin.
Well, this is a complicated question. I think, you know, all of us tend to procrastinate. I think in a couple, it's helpful to sit down together and work through the couple's priorities together. You know, one of the things that couples do that I learned in doing research for the book is they implicitly manage each the couple's joint memory. You go to a party, you get some piece of information.
about a new car or about an upcoming social engagement, it's likely that one partner is going to focus on that and remember it and the other won't. And this is worked out in, you know, sort of implicitly without talking about it.
This is the power of two. We had Joshua Schenck on. His new book is all about how teams can work better and all of that sort of thing. By the way, again, we're talking to Daniel Levitin. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club, Lafayette Public Library, Thursday evening. He's here with us now. And Stephen says, good question. Sometimes you forget something you need to remember before you write it down. Does Daniel Levitin have any tips for bringing back to mind something that has been forgotten?
Well, I don't. Hypnosis sometimes works. But, you know, if you always have a piece of paper with you and a pen, just, you know, try to get to it before you forget it. But I know what you're saying. I've forgotten a whole lot of stuff myself.
My mother used to say, if you forget it, it's not important. But she was wrong because I've forgotten stuff that's very important. Here's Patricia writes, I'm a retired teacher. My work life was very structured. Bells rang and we moved on to the next thing. Now I seem to have an aversion to schedules of any kind. It's hard for me to get organized and get things done. Can we organize our brains when we retire or go through a similar life change? How can I start having more routine in my day?
You know, it's very important, Michael, as we age and leave the workplace, we tend to narrow our social contacts. And so we lose the built-in social network we had at work. And it's important to maintain that, to stay in touch with other people. They help us to schedule our lives to some extent because we interact with others. And, you know, there are life coaches out there who will put you on a schedule and tell you you've got to exercise at this time and go shopping at this time and see a friend a certain number of times a week. That's very important to keep your brain active and to stay engaged with the world.
And we'll stay engaged with more of our callers. Rosalina, you're on. Hi.
Hello. In regards to multitasking, as a music educator, I've observed that multitasking in music making is based on both the skills converted into subconscious and those that we continue to monitor during the process of music making. How music education can foster so much coveted ability to multitask efficiently and effectively? And that links to juggling questions that we never heard.
I'm not sure that musicians are multitasking in the way that we usually use the word. When I think of multitasking, I think of a taxi driver fumbling with two cell phones at once and looking for a turn and maybe talking to his dispatcher and, you know, all these things that, as Michael Krasny pointed out, are very dangerous. Multitasking in these situations lowers your effective IQ by 10 points. It's equivalent to having smoked a joint. In music, what happens, as in bicycle riding and driving a car, when we become experts, we're able to relegate to the subconscious a lot of the fine motor control and a lot of the procedures, and then it takes over.
You're almost on a kind of automated system in some ways.
Right. And so if you're a pianist or a bicycle rider and you really know what you're doing, the quickest way to mess you up is to ask you to describe to somebody what you're doing while you're doing it. That's evidence that it's become an automated, what we in neuroscience would call an automated process. The beauty of that for a piano player is that once they don't have to think explicitly about where to put their fingers and their feet, their brain is free to think about the emotional aspects of the piece and then guide their fingers to create an emotional performance. I don't see that as multitasking. I see that as two parts of unitasking, two different things that are related to one another.
And as you could tell by my mention of Daniel Levitin's other books, he has certainly done a good deal of research in conjunction with music. He's also the author of This Is Your Brain on Music and The World in Six Songs. And here's Carolyn who writes, this may seem like a dumb question, but why, if our brains lag behind 20,000 years of our environment, why do we have brains with such storage capability? If we knew 100 people in a lifetime, why do we develop such capacity? If only to do one single task, why do we need such complexity? And thank you for this fascinating program.
Well, I don't see the brain as having been designed. It's not like somebody said, well, we're going to build in this capacity because humans will need it later. And I think that was implicit in your question. I think what happened is that those of our ancestors who had larger brains were the ones who were able to do things like harness the power of fire, invent the wheel, invent and use tools, and that was reinforced through natural selection. So the increased capacity of the brain also showed up in being an adaptable species. Humans live in almost every habitable corner of the earth. We find ways to make shelter and find food. Our hunter-gatherer ancestors had to be able to find a new source of water if the well went dry, to find new sources of food if the trees had a blight or died. And that kind of cognitive flexibility was very important for survival. Also, the increased brain capacity for thousands and tens of thousands of years was necessary to defuse the kinds of interpersonal tensions that occur in any primate living group. We humans are one of the few primates that are able to live in groups of larger than 30 or 40 members. Interpersonal rivalries become too acute, and in monkeys they cause the groups to split apart.
Well, I asked listeners for suggestions. Here Steve writes, I use three tools that have been effective for me: Google Calendar for events and appointments, a wonderful to-do list program from Germany called Wunderlist, and Evernote for long-term storage and organization of information. Another online comment about dyslexia. This is an email, actually. A listener writes, I'm curious to know if research is focused primarily on average brains or dyslexic brains. The research I've seen recently states that dyslexic brains are quite capable of multitasking, 3D modeling, and hyperfocus. In this way, a very unique way of not only seeing the world, but also organizing it. Several very famous dyslexics include Richard Branson, actors like Tom Cruise, famous scientists like Einstein. I don't know if he was dyslexic, but, you know, Malcolm Gladwell has this whole thesis that this has made them organize even better and more powerfully. Their dyslexia. That pretty much square with your research?
I reject the notion that dyslexia is necessarily an advantage, but certainly there are some dyslexics who have been very successful, but it's not a true experiment. We don't know if they would have been as successful without dyslexia. Maybe they would have been even more successful.
You can meet our guest, Daniel Levitin. He'll be at the Commonwealth Club in Lafayette Public Library Thursday evening. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, Michael. Pleasure.
Thank
always.
You, our listener. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, thank you for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.